Okay. All right, we are live in the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building, Greenwich Village, City of New York. We'll start tonight as we always do. To those of you who are in the clubhouse for the first time, welcome. To those who have been here before, welcome home. It's a pleasure tonight to welcome Marty Appel. Marty is the author of Pinstripe Empire, The New York Yankees from Before the Babe to After the Boss. In brief, this is truly a definitive history of the Yankees. It goes from 1903 to 2011. And I think the best way to start is by, I'd like to just read Marty's bio if I could. I think most of you probably know Marty or know of Marty, including the people listening to the podcast. But for those that don't, I just want to read his bio, which actually appears in Pinstripe Empire on page 621. And I think that says a lot right there about the job that Marty has done of 620 amazing pages leading up to his bio.
Thank you. It's only part one, actually.
So this is a note on the author. Marty Appel began his Yankee public relations career answering Mickey Mantle's fan mail in 1968 and went on to serve as public relations director and later as an Emmy Award-winning producer of Yankee telecasts on WPIX-TV. He has written for Yankees Magazine, MLB All-Star Game, and World Series programs, Sports Collector's Digest, and he has appeared on the YES Network's Yankeeography, as well as on documentaries on ESPN, HBO, and MSG Network. He is the author of 18 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Munson, The Life and Death of a Yankee Captain, Now Pitching for the Yankees, a memoir, Slide Kelly Slide, the Casey Award-winning biography of Mike King Kelly, and collaborations with Bowie Kuhn, Lee McPhail, Larry King, Tom Seaver, and umpire Eric Gregg. Appel is president of Marty Appel Public Relations and serves as magazine historian for the Baseball Hall of Fame's Memories and Dreams. So it is a pleasure to welcome Marty to the
Thank
club.
You.
And I guess the best way to start would be, you've written this exhaustive, detailed look at the Yankees, as we said, from 1903 to 2011. What prompted you to do this project? How did the project come about?
It was one of those projects that you think is, why didn't I think of it earlier? It was sort of always staring me in the face as a book that needed to be done. And yet, it didn't occur to me until my agent and I were kicking around some ideas, and they all were sort of Yankee-related. And then it was like, you know, I don't think anybody's done a history of the Yankees in like 50 years. And it turned out to be 70 years since Frank Graham did the last one. Now, there have been some beautiful coffee table books that are photo-driven by and large. Glenn Stout's book was a really terrific book. But not a typical traditional narrative history since Frank Graham in 1943. So I like books, I like history, and when that realization came, I said, this is the project.
And how long did it take you to, from that moment until you
finished? It took about 2.5 years between the research and the writing, and usually I write just on Saturday and Sunday mornings.
That's it.
Because I'm running a PR business right. The rest of the week, and the phones ring too frequently to let you concentrate. But I would find time during the week to do research and at least identify the sources that I wanted to get to. So it was kind of a full-time project for 2.5 years.
Wow. Amazing.
What I'm forever grateful for from the publisher is that the contract called for 135,000 words. And I knew I was going to run way over that, and I kept saying, what should I do? What should I do? And he said, well, keep writing, and we'll worry about it later. So it turned out to be 100,000 words over the contract. And I turned it in and I said, well, you got all the important moments that everybody expects, and you got 100,000 extra words of all the backstage stories and the personality profiles, if those go, it's not that interesting a book. So they read it and they said, we'll change our budgets, we'll make it work. So I'm forever grateful for that.
Terrific, because that those 100,000 words, that's what makes it truly unique.
That's what made it different.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I'm not sure exactly where to start in the 100 plus years that you cover, so I thought the best place would maybe be, we should start in the beginning, since
that's
in
what
the
I
beginning,
did.
God created the Yankees. So I had to get that in. So there's the New York Highlanders, sort of. If you could just give us, people I think know of the Highlanders and then becoming the Yankees.
Yeah.
If you could just tell us a little bit about sort of this Highlanders name.
Well,
and then
we
how
think today that they were the Highlanders and they played at Hilltop Park, but nicknames weren't as commonly used back then as they are today. And they were more commonly known as just the New York Americans, as opposed to the Giants, who were the National League team. And the newspapers more often call them the Americans or the New York Americans than they did the Highlanders. If you have access to the Times online, the whole, you know, run of the New York Times, and you just put in the search Highlanders, it doesn't show up until like 1907 or 1908 in the New York Times. And, of course, the journalists hated it from the start because it was too big for headlines and didn't lend itself to a nickname. So they started using Yankees as early as 1904. And it was, you know, the New Yorks more than anything, or the Americans. And as far as Hilltop Park, it was an appropriate name because if you've ever been up to Columbia Presbyterian or New York Presbyterian Hospital, it is on a very high elevation. So much so that you only can get to the subway platform with an elevator. You can't even walk it. Which is the same subway that they had there in like 1905 it opened. But so Hilltop Park was seldom referred to as Hilltop Park. On the fences it was said New York American League Park. And the scorecards, which I reproduce one in the photo section, makes no references to Highlanders, makes no references to Hilltop Park. So we've come to accept that usage today, but it wasn't really a big deal then. When they went to the Polo Grounds in 1913, then they officially became the Yankees.
And how did it become, what was the story behind the Yankees?
It was just a very patriotic word at the time, and the Yankees were trying to embrace the patriotism, particularly in, after the Spanish-American War. America was more patriotic than it had ever been, and Yankees was just sort of a rip-roaring American-sounding name. Now, by today's standards, when you want to sell your merchandise all over the place and you want to have a brand that works everywhere, if that had existed then, they wouldn't have been the Yankees because it was a very northern term, and they wouldn't have sold Yankee stuff in the South where there were still so many Confederate veterans living. They would never have bought Yankee material, Yankee merchandise.
It's very interesting. And one of the other interesting things that I think you did a masterful job of in the book...
Spelling?
That you did pretty well.
Spell check.
It helps. The what I think would make this book interesting, obviously all Yankee fans are going to love the book, but I think what also makes it interesting for baseball fans and people who just love history, and New York history in particular, which I do, besides loving baseball, I'm a big fan of New York history, as many people are, and you have some, you really follow, that's a kind of a story unto itself throughout the book. And if you could just talk a little bit about... for example, Police Chief Big Bill Devery, which you then get into Tammany Hall, even up to John Lindsay and so forth. But I thought Big Bill Devery was a fascinating character who many people may not know of.
He was the co-owner of the team with Frank Farrell. Frank Farrell operated all the pool halls in New York. And Devery was the police chief to whom Farrell would make his payoff so that the pool halls could operate. And Devery was considered, even in his lifetime, as the most corrupt police chief that New York had ever had. He made a craft, an art out of corruption. So this oversized guy who weighed like 300 pounds, he's the police chief, and he becomes a partner with Farrell in buying the team. Now, he's such a colorful character that he deserves to be remembered, and, you know, I write about his background. The reality is he had very little to do with the operation of the club, and his obituaries don't even make mention of his being part owner of the Yankees. But he ran for mayor once. He got, like, 11 votes. It was like...
All paid for.
But one interesting thing he did on the plus column is that after the Spanish-American War, Admiral Dewey was the hero of Manila Bay, and they decided to have a ticker tape parade for Admiral Dewey, the first time ever they had a ticker tape parade in New York. Devery was the police chief, and he was the one who laid out the route, which still exists to this day. So that was in 1898, and in 1998, there are the Yankees on that same parade route, and nobody thought to make the connection. Pretty interesting.
That is.
Yeah.
That is. And then, was that something you set out to do, is to sort of interweave this New York into the story of the Yankees?
Yeah, because it's very much the story of subway development, of the Giants trying to force them onto land where nobody would go, which is why they wound up in Washington Heights. The politics, certainly when it came to construction and building the stadiums and all, and the rise of Jacob Rupert to such prominence, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But Rupert was this major New York figure who was a four-term U.S. congressman and whose father started Rupert Brewery. And, you know, so he grew up in wealth. He was one of the wealthiest men in America and a politically very influential guy in New York.
We can keep going with Jacob Rupert now.
Well, a lot of people that I meet, younger people, never heard of Jacob Rupert. They look at me with a blank stare. And George Steinbrenner always used to like to say that buying the Yankees was like buying the Mona Lisa. Rupert was Da Vinci. He got Babe Ruth, he built Yankee Stadium, he created the dynasty, and he kind of set the tone for the professionalism and the way they carried themselves and everything. And he was a fascinating guy. One of my favorite sentences in here I wrote, Jacob Rupert looked like the sort of guy that expected to be handed a towel every time he washed his hands. Wealth in America you could define by Rupert. But the interesting thing, which I never realized until I began to just develop his character in the book, he owned the Yankees from 1915 till he died in 1939. And while he was very wealthy, and he certainly didn't scrimp and save on the running of the team, throughout the 20s, he had to deal with Prohibition, which effectively shut his brewery down. And then came the Great Depression in the 30s, which kept baseball as an industry from growing very much at all. They were barely managing to get by. So here was Rupert for most of the time he owned the Yankees, faced with those hardships. And yet he built this magnificent stadium and spent money lavishly on the players.
During his era, if we could maybe talk about the 27 Yankees, a team that many people consider still the greatest team of all time. I don't know if you would agree or disagree with that.
You can make that case largely on the fact that they did it with a 25-man roster that never changed. They had the same 25 players from opening day till the end. 110 games, won four straight in the World Series. It's like, beat that.
Yeah. Was that unusual for a 25-man roster not to change?
Very unusual.
Yeah.
I mean, today it's much more common.
Bring it out. Forget it. Yeah.
Each team winds up with like 50 guys at the end of the year who've played for their team. But back then it was still pretty uncommon.
And there's another interesting fact that I never knew about Babe Ruth never wearing the famous interlock, probably the most famous logo in the history of sports, the famous interlocking NY. Babe Ruth never wore that uniform.
I think he wore, by my count, he wore it three times, never as an active player. He wore it in that War Bonds game where he batted against Walter Johnson. He wore it on the famous farewell where he was photographed from the back by Nat Fine, that Pulitzer Prize-winning photo. And, forgetting for the moment the third occasion, but it was some exhibition. But Babe Ruth never wore the NY on his jersey. It was just the pinstripes and nothing else. And he also never hit one into the upper deck in right field, because for his entire career, the bleachers extended from foul pole to foul pole, and thus he had no upper deck to shoot for.
And let's go to...
The stadium opened, if you look at photographs from the early 20s, the foul pole was like as high as this cabinet. It was like they didn't give any consideration to height for the foul pole. So Bill Jenkinson, who's an expert on Ruth's home runs, he thinks that Ruth may have lost as many as 80 home runs that were called foul that might have been fair had the umpires had a decent foul pole to work with.
Wow. Do you feel he's the greatest player of all time?
I do. Certainly, the personality helps. He was so huge in every way. He drew fans in who never heard of baseball. He was as famous as the presidents and Charlie Chaplin. I mean, everybody knew who Babe Ruth was. And the newsreels in the theaters would always feature Babe Ruth. And of course, he followed the scandal of the 1919 World Series. And on the force of his innocence and his joy for the sport, he kind of saved baseball. And he's still like the face of the franchise. We used to have a thing when I worked there. I was the PR guy. And if one of us made a mistake in the front office, like let's say I got something wrong in the press notes that we gave out that night, and I realized, oh, I made a mistake here, I might say to a friend of mine, how bad do you think this is? And the answer would be something like, they released Babe Ruth.
That's words of wisdom for anybody. Well, if we could go now from the Babe to his teammate, Lou Gehrig. Something interesting that you brought out in the book is Lou, not in his playing days, so to speak, but when he gives the luckiest man speech, that was the first time his voice was actually heard by many people.
Yeah, because not too many people went to see his Western movie the year before Rawhide. And there weren't a lot of radio interviews. You know, there were some, but not many where we would recognize a voice, like you would certainly recognize today's players' voices. Kimberly Jones was not there after the game catching their thoughts.
Where is she now?
She's doing football somewhere. That's her real love.
Amicable split? I
mean, yeah, she just wanted to do football more than baseball. But anyway, Gehrig, interestingly, only 1 year did he have to himself, 1935, the year after Babe. And then DiMaggio comes in 36, and Lou is kind of again in the shadow of this heroic figure of Joe DiMaggio. But what a ball player. You know, without Babe Ruth, without Joe DiMaggio, Gehrig would be the face of the franchise, and a very proud one at that. Anyway, on Gehrig Day, he delivers the luckiest man speech. I found two friends, who were in the bleachers that day. So not only could they describe their memories of Lou Gehrig Day, but just the very experience of going to the ballpark in those days, squeezing down where you couldn't believe till people kept filling up those bleachers, and the smoke from the cigars and the cigarettes, that in a doubleheader you'd sit there in that smoke for 8 hours, you could barely see the field. What an experience that must have been.
That's a great picture. Yeah. I wish I was sitting there.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I always thought that speech, when you listen to it in its entirety, I think any politician should take a cue from that, where they have to read from teleprompters.
He had no PR guy.
It's amazing.
Which, of course, he should have.
Where were you?
Where was I? But, you know, it's a great speech just on the face of it, let alone that it was kind of extemporaneous, that there was no PR guy, he wasn't reading from any notes, and it's called Baseball's Gettysburg Address.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Was Frank Graham the PR guy for the Yankees or not?
Well, he was a journalist who covered him. They didn't have a PR guy, really, until after the war, World War II.
Since you mentioned Joe DiMaggio, let's move on to Joe DiMaggio. And feel free to say anything you'd like about him, but there's an interesting story about Old Timers Day that maybe ties in with Joe DiMaggio, or anything. Yankees Old Timers Day is obviously an entity unto itself. So if you want to just speak about DiMaggio, Old Timers Day, anything along those...
Well, I'll do one that Joe's kind of remembered for being insulted that he wasn't introduced last at an Old Timers Day. So you probably have heard that. And when I'm with an audience that has heard that, I like to give the full story because I was part of the team that decided Mickey Mantle should go last and Joe DiMaggio should go next to last. And what was behind that was that Mickey's fans were so much younger and so much louder, and he had just retired himself. So the first year that they're both on Old Timers Day, we bring out Mickey next to last, and the screams and the cheers and the adulation for Mickey were so overpowering that you didn't even hear DiMaggio's introduction. He came out almost like an afterthought, and the cheers didn't rise, they diminished, because his fans were older and not as demonstrative. So after that weekend, Bob Fischel, myself, and a couple of other people, we said, you know what, we probably ought to do it in reverse, so Joe gets his full due and his big ovation, and then comes Mickey. Well, we did that the next year, and Joe was very insulted by that. And so he threatened never to come back, and of course we retreated on that policy. But it made sense at the time. The other story I'm going to tell you about Old Timers Day is the famous year where Billy Martin was first hired to replace Bill Burton. And that was in 75, where we were at Shea Stadium. I was the PR guy, and I met Joe DiMaggio at the players' entrance at Shea to lead him to the clubhouse that the Old Timers were going to use. So I'm walking with them. Two or three minute walk, it was way down right field. And while we're walking, I said to him, well, I guess you heard the rumors. We're making a managerial change today, and Billy Martin's going to manage. This was the first time. And Joe, in his infinite wisdom, looked at me and he said, good luck with that. So he knew.
Well, actually, that leads me into a question I've always had. I always thought this was long before I had the clubhouse, long before I was making baseballs. I always wondered what it was like to work for George Steinbrenner, just as a boss in the business world. I've worked for maybe one boss that's a little wacky, but probably not at that level. And I was just wondering what that felt like on a daily basis to have you come into work. It's a job. It's, you know, like anything else. You happen to work for the Yankees, right? And George Steinbrenner is your boss. What was that like on a daily basis?
Well, it's interesting. I kind of can measure my career there, because when I started, all anybody wanted to know was why Mel Allen got fired. And when I finished, everybody wanted to know, what's it like to work for George Steinbrenner? first of all, we had no idea in those first few years that he would become such a nationally prominent, well-known person, portrayed on Seinfeld, and just everybody knew him, and he became the prototype for a tough boss. But you know what? There's a lot of tough bosses. They just don't all work for very high-profile teams or organizations. Most people in their lifetime have tough bosses.
Right.
The end result is, if you measure all the constituencies, we were a small and insignificant group, the people who worked for him. The players loved him because he paid so well. Opposing teams loved him because he filled their ballparks when the Yankees came to town. The media loved him because he was always so quotable. He was such an interesting, he was great copy. It's like they mattered in the baseball universe. And the 40 or 50 of us in the office who would have rough days with them, so what did it matter? You know, it was the end product and all the pennants and the victories and everything. Yeah, he was a tough boss. And there were days that you got so frustrated that you couldn't believe you could go back to work again the next morning and take more of this. But he also made us feel like we counted in this organization's success. I mean, we weren't out there on the field, but somehow our performance reflected on the whole New York Yankees. And you felt good when the team won because somehow you thought he had made us feel like we had something to do with this. So I learned a lot from him. My respect grew over the years. And when he died, I had a great sadness. I visited him like 6 or 7 months before he died. It was a really nice visit with him. And I felt very bad when he passed away. Although when he died, the Yankees were in first place. They were defending world champions. They displaced the All-Star game on the back page of the paper. He would have loved all of those circumstances.
Just like you wrote it up. That's perfect. Well, let's maybe turn to two guys who probably at moments loved him and hated him. And you can speak, say whatever you'd like about them. Billy Martin, let's take him first.
Well, as Joe DiMaggio said, good luck with that. I never personally had a bad moment with Billy Martin, but you always also had the feeling that when you were walking out of his office, he was giving you the finger. And in that context, Mickey Mantle once said that Billy Martin was the only guy he ever met who could hear someone give him the finger. Now, I do put in the book, because it was really a privileged conversation that I thought was worthy of the book. Now, I once sat on a Yankee charter flight with Billy, and I said to him, for every fight that you've had in your life that made the newspapers, and there were a lot of them, how many do you think you've had that never got in the newspapers? And he said, I guess about 10 for every one you heard of. So this man did spend his adult life getting into scraps. And I think part of the problem was that he was growing older, but he wasn't looking older. His hair was still dark, he was still in shape, he was trim, and he still saw himself as this fighting street kid from the streets of Berkeley instead of a maturing older guy.
Very interesting. You know how educated was he? When did he go? Finish high school? He didn't go to college, did he?
He didn't go to college. I think he finished high school. And then he played in the Pacific Coast League for Casey Stengel. When he came up in 1950, he sort of broke the mold. I don't know if we're going to get into integration of the Yankees, but you've all heard how Vic Power was denied being the first black Yankee because he was too flashy. That's one of the terms that was used. Well, you know what? Flashy white guys didn't make the Yankees either. It just was not the corporate culture in the Yankees to bring in anybody who sort of wasn't Bill Dickey and Lou Gehrig and Joe McCarthy. But Billy was the exception. He was the guy Casey brought up with him from the minor leagues who was not like all the other Yankees. And when he finally had a brawl at the Copacabana, although I don't think he threw any punches, but the Copa fight hastened his trade. It was essentially the first time he got fired. He got fired 5 times as manager, but throw in the 6th as a player.
Right. Yeah. Well, before we get to another guy who got fired as manager, let's touch on integration.
Well, they all get fired.
Yeah, that's true. Comes with the territory. But let's touch on integration. So
yeah. The Yankees were slow to integrate, no question. They weren't the last team of the original 16. Elston Howard came up in 55. So what was special about 55? They didn't win in 54. They won every year before then. They won 5 straight world championships from 49 to 53. And they never felt any compelling need to do anything that dramatic, in the, you know, as the times were, as to integrate the ball club. And then finally, they lose in 54, although they have a big season. And what do you know? Suddenly in 55, the team picture has a dark face. And, you know, how shocking that was for old traditional Yankees. Now, I'm sure the Yankees, like every other of the 16 teams then, would have had conferences in the front office where somebody would have said, well, you know, we risk losing all our white fans if we start integrating the team. I'm sure they all had conversations like that. It's easy to say today to say, well, that didn't happen. That was nonsense. But I'm sure that happened there. Given the times, they were slow. They weren't the last. And when they brought in Ellie Howard, they brought in a perfect guy. He was just a terrific person. It was my privilege to know him for the last 13 years of his life. And even Mickey Mantle from the Dust Bowl of Oklahoma, who might have been a guy carrying some prejudice, he said, I would have loved to have roomed with Ellie Howard my whole career.
Great story.
Yeah.
Which sets me up to the guy we skipped over that I was going to ask about. And I'd like you to say anything you'd like about him. And in particular, though, one area I'd like to touch on, that's Yogi Berra. So feel free to talk about
Yogi. Doesn't it make you smile when you just hear those
two
words?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Harvey Aronin was here a couple of weeks ago with Driving Mr. Yogi, and yeah, it's such a beautiful story. And feel free to talk about Yogi as much as you'd like, but there's one area that you speak about in the book that I would like to, you to touch on, is when Yogi managed his son Dale. I just think you have some insights into that, and I think that's just a fascinating, here's a father managing at ball club with his son on it. It has to touch on so many different emotions.
Well, the most emotional part of it was that poor Yogi got fired while Dale was on the team. What were the Yankees? Somebody will know. 5-8 at the time he got fired? Something like that.
They just lost a series in Boston.
Yeah, it was Chicago. And I know it's Chicago because I described the scene here where he gets fired. They're going to the airport, so Yogi's going to get a flight back to New York. The team's going to go on to wherever they are. So he takes a ride on the team bus, and the bus drops him off first by the terminal to go to New York. And I'm starting to feel emotional, but imagine you're on the bus, and everybody loves Yogi, and he just gets up to get off the bus all by himself, and the players just start applauding him. And there were two buses, and the players in the second bus were applauding, too, when they saw him go out there. And his son Dale was in the first bus, sitting near the back, crying. Everybody loves this man so much. If there was a Mount Rushmore in the Bronx, you'd have Ruth, Gary, DiMaggio, Mantle, and then who would be the fifth guy? To me, it's Yogi. The great American success story, minimal education, quit school to help earn money during the Depression for his parents. The only ball player to have been at D-Day, Normandy, he was a minor league player at the time, comes back, goes into the Yankee clubhouse in his naval uniform, and Pete Sheehy, he asked Pete Sheehy for a uniform, and Pete later said, he didn't even look like a sailor, let alone a ball player. But this guy who has, first of all, are you aware he's been doing television commercials since 1949? There's nobody who's done, I mean, when Yogi goes in to do a TV commercial, he knows more about it than anybody in the room. Just as he knows more about baseball than anybody, ever. He's just Albert Einstein in this craft. And he is such an uncommonly decent guy with the perfect instincts to never do anything wrong. He always gets it right. And anybody who knows him personally just loves him so. I talk in there about he's a good Catholic, which he is. And, you know, you got to perform some miracles to make sainthood. Well, we could make a case for Saint Yogi. The Miracle Mets in 69, you know, he's a coach. He comes back to the Yankees in 76. And they finally win again. George Steinbrenner goes to his museum in New Jersey to apologize to him and break the feud after all those years. The Allie Reynolds, where he drops the foul pop on the no-hitter. And then Ted Williams, it's another foul pop, and Yogi catches it. I mean, there's three there you can choose from. Saint Yogi to me.
And excuse me, what did you think of the birthday celebration that they had last week at the stadium?
It was a sweet ceremony. I mean, it was nice that Guidry was driving them because it played.
But I thought, it was like, I don't know, maybe I anticipated and expected too much.
I think so.
Somebody should say something, they just somebody saying but he can't do anything. We accept that.
Yeah, I mean, he'll be slowing down. There are days he doesn't get out of the house much. Yeah. I thought he looked great that day.
No,
and it was perfect. I thought it was just fine. Yeah.
So let's go now with...
ask a long question. I want to take a...
Well, we're going to get to questions from our crowd, but just a couple of last things that I wanted to touch on. There's a story about Gene Michael, who did a fantastic job in the front office during some crazy times. There was a moment he pondered trading Mariano Rivera. And if you could...
Well, this is, how history could have turned. 96, Tony Fernandez gets hurt in spring training. He was going to play shortstop. And so they're faced with, is Derek Jeter ready to play shortstop? They knew in the future he was their shortstop, but they didn't know in 96 he was major league ready. So they thought, maybe for protection, let's get a more seasoned veteran and go into the season with the seasoned veteran and maybe bring Jeter along more slowly. So the discussion evolved into, serious possibilities of trade, and they began to focus attention on Felix Fermin with the Seattle Mariners. He'd been with Cleveland. I don't know if you remember Felix Fermin. So it was going to be, do we trade Mariano Rivera, this other prospect we have, for Felix Fermin? So let's say they do that. They lose Rivera, and Fermin has a career year. We don't need Jeter. We got Fermin. It's amazing how things could turn.
Yeah.
And as they always said, the best trades are the ones you don't make.
That was definitely the best trade.
Yeah.
Yeah, without question. And now, so that leads us into the core four. Do you think that will ever happen again, where you have four guys like this who come up together for any team, really?
In Posada, Mariano, and Jeter, you had the only three guys in any sport teammates for 17 seasons. That happened last year.
Yeah.
17 years together in any of the major sports. Remarkable. And also very good, likable guys. Kind of the history of the Yankees is there's always been the Yankee haters. And for Yankee haters, you could still root against the Yankees when your team is playing them. But hard to hate Jeter and Bernie Williams and Joe Torre and Mariano Rivera. A lot of good guys emerged in this current era that made the Yankees more likable than maybe they'd ever been before.
Absolutely. I know quite a few Met fans whose favorite player is Derek Jeter. So
yeah,
it says a lot.
And the tributes to Mariano when he went down were heartwarming. They were wonderful. From Red Sox Nation and everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so let's turn it to our Yankee fans. And
two things. First of all, anything being done to put Ali Reynolds into the Hall of Fame?
Well, he only got one vote last time
it's
around.
It's unbelievable. Because I see people, I don't think he could have shined his spikes, who just seem to like walk in, and I won't mention any names.
What's interesting is that when the era of Reynolds, Rashi, and Lopat ended, I don't think anybody at that moment would have said Reynolds is the Hall of Famer and not the other two guys. They were so interchangeable. They were thought of kind of as a unit. And now it's clearly emerged. There's a plaque in the outfield for Reynolds and not the other two. I think he's clearly emerged as the Hall of Fame candidate between the three of them, and I'd love to see it.
And the second thing is sometimes things get passed over in history and you have to dig up in somebody's letter 75 years later, oh, look, this happened. And what happened to me was that I saw Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe come out of the, I think, Game 5 of the 1960 World Series. And I was a little kid. I went to that school that's just behind Yankee Stadium. So the flags were flying. They're playing during the day. I was at the stadium. Sorry. But and it was the World Series. They let us into the... for free into the PAL, into the bleachers, and I used to hang out to get the autographs at the press door.
Right.
And I'm waiting there, and the door opens, and it's like Joe D steps out. He looks completely uncomfortable with all these people hanging out. He's just like, if he could have like gone into the concrete, he would have, And everybody went, ooh.
Well, if you had seen me coming out with Marilyn Monroe, I would have looked at
him. He came out alone.
Oh, I see.
Then the door opens up again, and Marilyn Monroe comes out. And everybody not only went, ooh, but they rushed forward, which was the difference Joe probably couldn't stand was the fact that everybody went, or is that story about, like, when they went on their honeymoon and they took Marilyn Monroe to Korea, and she came back, she said, Joe, it's amazing. Have you ever experienced 50,000 people all calling
your name?
It's a good
imitation.
And as I tell people, when she was on top of the stairs, I was 13, and she passed me by, I was 35. My voice changed automatically. I've never seen anybody write about that. I've never seen photographs of it. I know the press were there taking pictures, and it's just lost.
Well, there was a lot the press didn't write about in those days.
Talk about three players, Phil Rizzuto, Reggie Jackson, and Pokey Rowe, Darnay Monzi.
Just statements about all of them?
I'm curious some of the stories about that.
Munson was a grumpy guy, and I liked him, but he was not a PR man's dream. And the story I like to tell is that for years and years when he first came up, if I'd ask him to pose for a photo, like with a sponsor or a sponsor's kid before the game, which you do, he would always say, I don't do that. And he'd grumble away. And I'd go, all right, I know where I stand with Thurman Munson. Then in 76, he became captain of the team, and suddenly he had new responsibilities. He's the team captain. And I'd still try. I'd go, could you be in front of the dugout in 15 minutes? We've got to get this photo with the Schaefer Beer people. And he'd remember he was captain, and he'd say, okay, I'll be there. And then he'd never show up. And I really liked him the other way, where you knew where you stood. Reggie?
Reggie and Phil.
Reggie was tough for PR people, too, because he was his own PR guy. He cultivated his own relationships with the media, and he was sort of off to the races on his own. One of the reasons he was pretty unpopular in the clubhouse, whether it was in Oakland or Baltimore, New York, California Angels, back to Oakland, is that he so courted the press, and that's not the clubhouse code. It's like they're the enemy. So the other players really never liked Reggie that much, and when he created that schism with Munson, where he said, I'm the straw that stirs the drink, in his first spring training with the Yankees, what are you thinking? I mean, it was so stupid, and it just gave Thurman 23 instant best friends, and Reggie was alone in that clubhouse. But then the last game of the season, the last game of the World Series, three home runs, nobody's got a bigger smile in the dugout than Thurman Munson, and all was forgiven, because in the end, winning was everything. And the third one was Phil Rizzuto. Loved the guy. I was executive producer of the telecasts on Channel 11, so I was essentially his boss, but we both knew better. He was the one who carried the, you know, I would say, Phil, we got to give it a rest with the birthdays. It's enough. Oh, okay. And he wouldn't do any birthdays for like two innings. And then he'd start with the birthdays. But we remember him like that, with the birthdays and the cannolis and the leaving early. He wasn't always like that. First of all, he was a very professional broadcaster. And before the game, if we had to record promos or commercials or anything, one take. He never needed a second take. He was always great. And he used to do this show on CBS Radio Network where Herb Gorin, great old sports writer, would write his script, would fax it to whatever city we were in. Phil would take a cab to the local CBS affiliate. He'd tell the cab to wait on the street. He'd go up to the studio. He'd record whatever Herb Gorin had written for him. And he'd run back down into the cab and go off to the ballpark. And he made more money on that show than he did on the WPIX telecasts. And good for him, because he was always very underpaid for the popularity he brought to the Yankees.
Mentioned about Billy Martin sort of breaking the mold. It wasn't sort of Casey Stengel, his hiring, his whole
Sort
of breaking the mold for the
in a way.
Casey
broke the mold too the year before Billy came up. There was a lot of parallel to Joe Torre's hiring and Casey Stengel's hiring, in that both had long, undistinguished records in the National League. Casey was considered a clown. Torre wasn't, but he had that awful headline when he came to New York, Clueless Joe, which wasn't about him being dumb or anything. It was about he doesn't know what he's getting into. That's what the clueless part meant. There was a lot in common there in that sense. Torre, I'm switching from Casey to Torre on this because I wanted to make a point on Joe. I think he's the best manager that the team ever had, and here's why. The discussion would be Miller Huggins, Joe McCarthy, Casey Stengel, and Joe Torre. And when you compare Torre to the other three guys, Torre had to beat 13 American League opponents, not seven like the others. Torre had to win three rounds in the postseason, not just the World Series. Torre and only Torre had this ultra-demanding boss. Torre and only Torre had to deal with millionaire ball players from all different nations and all different backgrounds. And Torre and only Torre had to deal with 24/7 news cycle, with second guest all the time on sports talk radio, and Mike and the Mad Dog, and blogs came in. So Torre had all this stuff going on and managed to have so much success where the other guys could have phoned it in almost.
Go back to what we talked about, integration. You couldn't, and Vic Power could not make it since he was too flashy, so they had to wait for Elston Howard because he sort of fit the mold. Do you think Jackie Robinson could have given his characteristic and his powerful personality, would he have fit in with the Yankees?
That's a very good question. I never really thought through the answer. I mean, a part of the Robinson equation was Branch Rickey. And I don't know as the Yankees had a Branch Rickey in the front office who would have worked with them through that difficult first year. So I think possibly not for that reason, not for any fault of Jackie's. Just a hunch.
I want to hear about your first job as the person who opened Mickey Mantle's How did you get that job, and what top that?
Well, the story was I wrote a letter to Bob Fischel, the legendary Yankee PR guy, looking for any summer job. And I told him I was 18 at the time. I was in college, and I was looking for a summer job. Of course, summers in college are like almost as long as the baseball season. And I really didn't expect a response, but looking back at it now, this was a time in the late 60s when baseball was not very cool and people my age were not baseball fans, so he wasn't getting 1,000 letters a day looking for this job. It was like a refreshing breath of fresh air that somebody 18 years old wanted to work for the Yankees. Well, I didn't think so, but that was the case. And he knew that Mickey was no longer answering his own fan mail. It was hundreds of letters a day, and they all said the same thing. They weren't very interesting. Dear Mickey, you're my favorite player. Please send me an autographed baseball. And really, they all said the same thing. So Mickey was ignoring it. But for Bob Fischel knew for every letter that went unanswered, that was a potential Mets fan. So he knew those letters needed to be answered. He brought me in for an interview. I had won one of the Yankee scorecard contests the year before, and he was the guy that created the scorecard. So he loved meeting a winner from the scorecard. He's now applying to work here. So he hired me. That was 1967 to start in 68, to start with the following season. So I was there for Mickey's final year. And despite how ordinary those letters were and how uninteresting they were, somehow I'd always find two or three that I had to go over with Mick in person. So I'd have some FaceTime with him. And we struck up a friendship that lasted until he died. And it made no sense. I mean, this guy from Oklahoma who spins at the top of the world with all these famous teammates, and this little Jewish kid from New York who was coming in to answer the fan mail. but we liked each other, and he liked me, and I'm used to go home and say, Mickey Mantle knows my name. Can you believe this?
Did you specialize in signing his name?
I don't have any memory of
no
that.
No comment.
I don't remember that at all.
Wait.
The other night in Camden Yards, somebody hit a home run, and a Yankee fan happened to catch it.
I saw that.
Arguably, the New York outfielder had a shot at it. So, of course, that generated a lot of Jeffrey Mayer discussion.
Yeah.
I remember watching, and I thought the Yankees were doomed. But for the Mayer incident, it turned everything around. Anything that people would concur, people who were familiar with the Yankees, that somehow the Jeffrey Mayer incident really turned that series, that postseason around, and then maybe led to...
Well, it was a clear home run. There was never a doubt. Jeffrey Mayer's a good kid, and I still keep in touch with him. Of course, he gets his name in the Yankee history book now. He played in independent ball. He played third base after he played in college. He's a nice kid. And got into the Yankee history book. And that was his bar mitzvah present, I think, going to the...
Marty, I just started reading Pinstripe Empire, so I haven't got up to the era I want to ask about. Could you shed some light on the Mayor's Cup when the Mets came in? Mayor's Trophy game, yeah. What was it like from the Yankee perspective? How much pressure was it on the team?
Well, they used to play it between the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Giants, so it resumed when the Mets were born. And the most interesting thing about it was the Mets fans were immediately more boisterous, and they started bringing signs to the game, which Casey would call placards, the Mets fans with their placards. So the first time that the Mayor's Trophy game was in Yankee Stadium, the ushers were told to confiscate the placards because we don't do that at Yankee Stadium. Well, the press loved that. That was just a fantastic story that day. And before you knew it, the Yankees not only gave in, but were having banner days themselves. But that was the first meeting of the two cultures clashing. And those games were fun for many years. But then they began to lose their luster. Both teams were now playing like guys from the minors that they brought up that day. And ultimately... the schedule was such, when doubleheaders sort of disappeared, that there were so few off days, it was very hard to coordinate a day when they could play. And since the beneficiary of the games was New York Sandlot Baseball, both teams simply decided to make donations to Sandlot Baseball and not play the game. I don't think anybody mourned it. And, of course, now we have interleague play, so it's more meaningful and it's more common.
I want to ask about how PR has changed in the modern world, but I also want to know this relationship between the Yankees and Kansas City. What's that all about, where Kansas City almost seemed like a farm team for Yankee stars?
It's an interesting part of the book because I learned a lot of things that I never fully understood, and that the owner and the general manager of the Kansas City Athletics both had relationships to the Yankees. The owner, Arnold Johnson, actually owned the lease on Yankee Stadium. And Park Carroll, who was the general manager, had been a Yankee front office employee. So there was a very incestuous relationship there. And those trades just went on and on and on. And the Yankees just got anybody who was good on Kansas City, culminating in Roger Maris. Then Charlie Finley buys the team after Arnold Johnson dies. And he says, that's it, we're making no more trades with the Yankees. Frank Lane was his general manager that year, and Lane makes one more. He trades Bud Daly to the Yankees, who becomes part of the great 61 Yankee team, and he fires Frank Lane for making that trade. So that just went on and on, that relationship, from the time that Kansas City was born until Finley bought the team.
Because of the time with the podcast, we're going to have to say farewell to our podcast audience. If Marty would like to stay, we're glad to have him in the clubhouse. But to our podcast audience, once again, the book Pinstripe Empire, The New York Yankees from Before the Babe to After the Boss by Marty Appel, published by Bloomsbury. And I would just like to end with two quick things. There's a quote by Fritz Peterson, a former Yankee pitcher, maybe more famous for a wife being swapping his wife with another Yankee. But Fritz had a tremendous line, the best book I have ever read other than the Bible.
And he used to run the baseball chapel, so
The
man has knows his
he
Bible.
Knows, yeah, there yeah. you go. And to close, I'd like to just tell a quick story about Billy Joel. I don't know if Billy Joel is a Met fan or a Yankee fan, frankly, but he was being interviewed once, and the interviewer was going on and on about how amazing he was and what a great musician, and he finally said, listen, I'm not a great musician. I'm competent in an incompetent world. But tonight I would like to thank Marty Appel, who is clearly great at what he does. So, thank you.